From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Venezuela devalues its currency. Turkey's lira continues to have problems. What sparks these currency crises? What happens when money dies? And what does it mean for U.S. foreign policy? Welcome to Foreign Edition. I'm Mary Kissel with the Wall Street Journal editorial board here in New York City. And I am very pleased to welcome a special guest today, Steve Hanke, the professor of applied economics at the Johns Hopkins University and director of the Troubled Currency Project at the Cato Institute. He is the author of many, many books, op-eds for us and other publications, and has advised multiple governments on currency policy. He is, ladies and gentlemen, the world's expert on currency crises. So, Steve, welcome to the show.
Murray, it's wonderful to be with you.
Let's start just by talking about Venezuela, where dictator Nicolas Maduro rolled out his latest economic reform plan, and I'll put that in quotes, earlier this week, the centerpiece of which was a giant devaluation of the local currency called the Bolivar and the launch of a new currency called the, quote, sovereign Bolivar. Steve, what is the thinking, if there is thinking, behind this devaluation, and how is it supposed to work?
When a country hyperinflates, Mary, the monthly inflation rate exceeds 50% per month. So in Venezuela today, I use high-frequency data to measure the inflation rate both on a monthly and annual basis. And today, the monthly rate is 137%. And the annual rate is 51,836%. So Venezuela is hyperinflating. That's a rather rare thing in history. There have only been 58 hyperinflations in world history. Mm. And Venezuela, out of the 58, it comes in at about number 23. So it's kind of a modest one, but it's still very nasty.
So
and what happens with these things is that you end up with what I call a wheelbarrow problem, and that is to buy a hot dog, you have to take a wheelbarrow full of bolivars into the shop, and the shop won't even count the bolivars. They'll weigh them and see if you have roughly enough to buy the hot dog. So as a result of that wheelbarrow problem, You have to redenominate the currencies. You have to exchange old bolivars for, in this case, sovereign bolivars, and it required 100,000 old bolivars to be exchanged for one sovereign bolivar. So that was the so-called reform plan. The essence of it is taking zeros off. In this case, five zeros were removed from the old bolivar. And now we have the sovereign bolivar.
So the currency is basically becoming more and more worthless by the day. Therefore, prices are going up because it's going to cost you more of those devalued bolivars to buy the same asset. But Steve, just by cutting zeros off, that doesn't change the underlying economic fundamentals. Has there ever been a case where cutting zeros off has actually ended or fixed that hyperinflation?
No, you have to do something more than the cosmetic kind of change that you've talked about. Mary, it would be the same thing if you went into a plastic surgeon today and had a facelift. you might look a little different than you do today, but nothing would really change.
It's still going down.
It's still going down. Now, In the case of, I can give you some examples of this. And the world's hyperinflation record was in July of 1946 in Hungary. And the pengo was the currency at that time. And it was exchanged for the forint, which is a currency now used in Hungary. And during that exchange of pengo for forint, they took 29 zeros off.
Wow.
Of the thing. In Yugoslavia, where I was actually the chief advisor to the Markovic government, when communism fell, they wanted to reform the economy and the currency and everything else. And they brought me in, and from 1990 until the Civil War started, there I was in Belgrade observing what was going on. And they had experienced 20 years of inflation prior to 1990, in which the inflation rate average was 79% per year in Yugoslavia. So they did just exactly what Maduro did in Venezuela. And in January of 1990, against my advice, by the way, totally against my advice, they did a so-called currency reform in which they introduced what they called a convertible dinar. And they took four zeros off at the time. By the time 1994 rolled around, they'd taken 27 zeros off, and they'd done five of these so-called reforms, renaming the currency, redenominating, and so forth. It didn't do a thing. They didn't change the monetary regime and the rules of the game. And the inflation rate in January of 1994 in Yugoslavia was 313 million% per month.
People can't live under those conditions. Steve, my understanding in Venezuela, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Venezuelans have both a monetary and a fiscal problem, because the prior government, the Chavez government, and the current government, the Maduro government, spent way beyond their means. They thought the oil price was going to stay high forever. So they expanded the social welfare state, took on a lot of debt. And then on the monetary side, because, of course, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. We know that from Milton Friedman. They simply printed too much currency. They've devalued the currency. What say you to that analysis?
Well, I say you're right. I agree with that. I would add a couple of points, and that is hyperinflation. Milton Friedman, of course, is exactly right. Inflation is always a monetary phenomenon, but you have to look at why the printing press gets turned on. And ultimately, it's always really a fiscal problem, because the government spends money and they don't have adequate financing sources. In other words, in this case, a tax base is drying up. The international bond market is cut off. The domestic bond market is cut off.
So they can't borrow to fund the fiscal hole.
They can't borrow from anyone except the central bank. So they go to the central bank and they say, we've got some wonderful paper we want to sell you. And the governor of the central bank says, of course, it really looks great. And he turns on the printing press. And at the extreme, this is what's going on in Venezuela. But again, at the extreme, and I observed this very carefully in Yugoslavia, and by the end, in January of 1994, inflation, 313 million% a month, 95% of all Yugoslav government expenditures were being financed by the central bank and the printing press.
Wow.
95%. So we're not talking about a small 5 or 6%. And these hyperinflations, you're talking about huge chunks of the government expenditure that's discredit from the central bank.
You know, Steve, it reminds me of that classic history of Adam Ferguson, When Money Dies, that chronicled the German currency crisis of 1923, I believe. And what I took away from that book was not just the mechanics of how money dies, which you've just described to us in Venezuela's case, but also the human toll. You know, people just unable to buy basic goods, elderly people with their savings just completely inflated away, a lifetime of work, young people unable to find work because the economy, of course, collapses when money dies. And you see this again today in Venezuela.
Well, you really can see it, Mary. When you look at the money dies aspect of the thing, you've got at least 4 or 5 million Venezuelans have emigrated out of the country because they're literally starving. And And that's one aspect of the problem. Now they're creating so much trouble in Brazil and Colombia and Ecuador that they're shutting the border. So these poor people are like, they're trapped in a cage. And money is dying on them. So it's just a terrible situation from a human point of view.
We're talking about Venezuela, currency crises, and when money dies. And you're listening to Foreign Edition from The Wall Street Journal.
Robert Half research indicates 9 out of 10 hiring managers are having difficulty hiring. Robert Half is here to help. Our recruiting professionals utilize our proprietary AI to connect businesses with highly skilled talent. At Robert Half, we know talent. Visit roberthalf.com today.
Drive time, gym time, anytime. WSJ Podcasts. From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Foreign Edition. Now, Mary Kissel.
Welcome back to Foreign Edition. Mary Kissel here in News Corporation headquarters in the middle of New York City. And I'm on with Johns Hopkins economics professor Steve Hanke, the world's expert in currency crises. Steve, we were just talking about the problems in Venezuela, the bolivar on its deathbed. But we also have currency crises in Iran with the rial and Turkey with the lira. Is there a chance here that we'll see contagion, a global panic? Or are these crises really confined to these nations' borders?
It's a little bit hard, obviously, to predict a contagion. But and Venezuela is a special case, so I think I would take that one kind of off the table. The ones that are of concern are, earlier this year, we've had a big plunge in the peso in Argentina. And Turkey, we've had a plunge in the Turkish lira. Both of those things have lost about 38% of their value this year. Then South Africa, we're down about 15%. Russia is down about 14%. Even Chile is down about 8% this year. Now, the overall picture is one, Mary, in which the U.S. dollar is very strong right now. And the most important price in the world is the dollar-euro rate.
Why is that, Steve?
Well, the dollar-euro rate today is, and I'm looking at that, we're at 1.6 right now in real time. And my comfort zone is for that rate is about 120 to 140.
But why do you look at that rate specifically, Steve, for listeners who might not follow currency markets?
Well, if you don't follow currency markets, you have to realize that most things are actually priced in dollars. Almost all commodities are priced in dollars. Most of the foreign reserves held by central banks are in dollars. The big payment systems in the world are denominated in dollars. The dollar is the international currency. And by the way, they're always, if we go back 2,500 years, you find there always was one international currency through all history. Their average lifespans are about 300 years. But at any rate, the dollar right now is the international currency. And the second currency in importance is the euro. So that rate between the dollar and the euro, it happens to be very important. That's a very important price. And right now, with the U.S. dollar at 1.6, it's strong. It's lower than the 120 rate. A few years ago, it was weak. It was over the 140.
So with the dollar strengthening, that means that countries like Turkey that have borrowed a lot of money in dollars and overextended themselves and now see their local currencies falling in value versus the dollar, that makes it harder for them to pay back those debts. That's a bad cycle to get into.
Yeah, you put your finger exactly on the nub of the problem, and that is that once the dollar gets strong, and in my view, overly strong, because I think the Fed is overly tight, actually, right now, and that's indicated also by the price of gold. my comfort zone for gold is about $1,200 to $1,400 an ounce. And today, it actually dropped a little below 1,200 a few days ago. Now it's just slightly over 1,200. So that indicates dollar strength, gold price weakness, you see, in dollar terms. And what happens is, you say, you've got the debt burden on these emerging market countries goes up and up and up. That becomes more difficult on them. And also, capital starts flowing out of those emerging market countries, and their currencies get weak. And that brings, by the way, local inflation to the countries that are experiencing currency weakness.
Yeah, so, and human misery and suffering and potential instability that does create a foreign policy challenge for the United States, Venezuela being the most obvious in our hemisphere, just a couple of hours' flight from Miami, and also the source of what I would expect to see major refugee flows as people try to flee. They'll be the next boat people. But Steve, it's interesting, though, you know, in all those countries that you named, it's the same fundamental problem. It's fiscal overreach and or government overreach. In the case of Turkey, for instance, Erdogan building, you know, bridges and roads and promising social welfare spending. In South Africa, the leaders there of the ANC threatening to expropriate private property, kind of arbitrarily sending foreign investment fleeing. So, you know, the individual causes might be different, but the underlying themes are exactly the same.
Right, right. And the thing is, back to your pointed question that you raised, you said, well, is there a possibility for contagion? And I said, it's a little bit hard to predict. However, we're in kind of a vulnerable zone. Once the dollar gets a little out of balance in relationship to the euro and gold, and is very strong, you have a situation where, okay, we've had problems in Argentina, we've had problems in Turkey, and then you go on down the line, and is there going to be one of these things that pops up that is the straw that breaks the camel's back? And you just never quite know.
You know, Steve,
right now it's been contained, but we don't really know.
Well, you know, we published an editorial here at the Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago about Iran. And actually, maybe Iran is the exception to my hypothesis, because Iran's currency troubles are a direct result, I believe, not just of the corruption and economic mismanagement of the regime in Tehran, which is undeniable. Large swaths of it are controlled by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. It's a classic case of, you know, kind of a criminal syndicate running a country, and we're having control over it. Think about, you know, Suharto's Indonesia. But U.S. sanctions have also played a role there and sparked that withdrawal from the rial into the dollar, correct?
Well, yes, the sanctions have. And speaking of you've got the internal criminal element or mafioso type thing with the Revolutionary Guard, as well as, don't forget, the religious foundations are exactly the same thing. As a result, the private sector is just very tiny in Iran. It's been squeezed down since the revolution of 1979. So everything is vulnerable. Everything is mismanaged. There's a tremendous amount of corruption, if not criminality. And when you put the sanctions on, that does tighten the noose. There's something called the Afghan effect. This is Bob Mundell's observation. In 1980, the Soviets had invaded Afghanistan. President Jimmy Carter was in office in the White House, and his national security advisor was Brzezinski. And Brzezinski advised that we should weaponize food and to do that and to punish the Soviets. And the weaponization was as follows. We would prohibit the export of U.S. grain to the Soviet Union. And as a result of that, we have the Afghan effect that Mundell observed. And the Afghan effect is, if you put sanctions on somebody, if you're beating somebody with a stick, what's the recipient of that beating want to do? They want to escape. And they escape, in this case, In Afghanistan, the Soviets escaped the grain embargo by going to Argentina and buying grain at a very good price. It was a very good deal for the Argentine farmers. It was a good deal for the Soviets. It was a very bad deal for American farmers. And on top of that, it was a very good deal for, remember, the junta. The junta was in power then. The bad guys were in power, and they were flooded with foreign reserves as a result of these grain sales and the economy boom. So that's the Afghan effect. Everything is connected to everything else. You put sanctions on somebody, they try to escape. So in Iran, back to Iran in the current day, the Afghan effect is that you put sanctions on, and what does it do? They try to escape. And the escape routes are all manned by international criminal organizations. So these routes are spawning and generating huge profits for the international mafias that run the channels. It also has geopolitical implications, and that is obviously the Iranians go from the prohibited suppliers of things like Total, the big French oil company that was down in the south part of southern part of Iran in the gas field, and now who they're prohibited from being there, or they have decided they wanted to avoid secondary sanctions by the United States, so they got out. And who fills the vacuum? China.
Right. And there are still more sanctions to come in the coming weeks. That was just the fall in the rial happened after, in anticipation, rather, of the first tranche of reimposed sanctions. So the message is sanctions may have many unintended consequences. And we should be on the lookout for contagion, perhaps, as money dies in Venezuela and elsewhere. That's it for Foreign Edition today. On behalf of Steve Hanke and me, Mary Kissel, thanks for listening. We'll be back with you later this week.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.